Accession number 11487, Eric Jones, Reel 5.
Eric Jones, Reel 5.
We got on this boat at in Glasgow itself, actually, and we went down and then we had to wait to go through the boom and then out to sea, and it was like a holiday trip, really. We were in convoy, but we went to Freetown, and I tried to get ashore in Freetown. Two of the fellows were going ashore because it got toothache, and I tried to fake toothache, but they wouldn't let me off. I had to stay on the boat, and then we went off into the Atlantic in convoy, and suddenly one morning we woke up to see the convoy splitting up and boats going off in all directions. It was a fascinating sight, really. They had a planned routine, but to see the way they did it was unbelievable, because there were about 30 boats in this convoy, and it went all off. And then we sailed on for about 2 days, and then the wireless operator told us that one of the boats in the convoy had been sunk. He'd just picked up the message. And then we went to Cape Town, and from Cape Town, we had 3 days in Cape Town, and remarkably enough, I walked on the station there and bumped into a fellow I knew from home, just completely out of the blue, there he was. Anyway, after about 3 days, we went on up to Aden, and we waited in Aden for a boat to cross the Gulf, and we were told that the previous party that went out had got on a destroyer, and there was a Polish destroyer took them over, and he got on this destroyer at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they said to the captain, "Well, when are we going to get to British Somaliland?" And he said, "Oh, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon." And I think it was 2:55 in the afternoon, they dropped anchor off British Somaliland. When we went, there was only an Arab dhow, and we got on this dhow about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and chugged out of the harbour at Aden and through the boom, and they closed the boom behind us, and then we sailed off and went 200 or 300 yards, and the engine broke down. The next morning when we looked back, we just seemed to be about another few hundred yards further off, you could see Aden as clear as could be, and they put the sails up, we slowly floated across. There was hardly a breath of wind, and we just drifted across, and we had these crew catching fish and cooking them on this wooden boat on a big stone in the middle of the boat, this fire burning. We thought, well, what happens if the boat catches fire, because there's no lifeboat at all, just a little tiny two-seater rowing boat. Anyway, we drifted across, and after 3 days, we could just see the signs of land. And the night came, and suddenly the wind blew up, and we shot across the last 2 or 3 miles so fast that we ran onto a sandbank off the mouth. It took us ashore next day. It had taken us 3 days. It had taken the other fellows from 9 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And we went overland to Diridar, and that was fascinating, because I saw a mirage for the first time in my life. I saw some most beautiful birds. Then we went by train up to Addis. That was quite interesting. Everything was so interesting, the new country, and it was really quite exciting.
And your journey back, was that...
The journey back was very good, because we came out, the two of us went up to Eritrea and got a train from there that took us in to the Sudan. And as we were going along, the train stopped at a station in the middle of the night, I would guess about 2 o'clock in the morning, and an army officer got on the train with a bottle of whiskey in his hand, and it appeared he was the only British person in this little town. The nearest British personnel were hundreds of miles away from him, and he met this train in every time he came past, I don't know how many nights a week it was, with his bottle of whiskey, so he could have a drink with some other Englishman on the train. If that isn't a typical mad Englishman. Anyway, we went on to into the Sudan, and then got a train to a point on the Nile, and went up by paddle steamer to Shilal, and there was quite a lot of folk on the boat. There was just this other chap with me from the unit, Jim Milne. And Jim, I tried to persuade Jim to get off the train at Luxor so we could go and see the Valley of the Kings, and he wouldn't get off. And so we had to go on, we went on to Cairo. But I was quite disappointed then, because I thought here was an opportunity to to see it. But that was quite good. And then I'd been in Cairo a few days, and I went on holiday to Jerusalem over Christmas. And then eventually got a hospital ship to Italy to join the blood transfusion unit in Italy.
Did you have any training for that, you know, the blood transfusion work?
No. No, I didn't really. This is, again, you're sort of like... we had a wonderful setup, very crude. I don't think the medical profession would realise how crudely we blood-typed people. We had two fluids. One was A, and the other was B. That was blood groups. And we had a tile. There was nothing specially made. It was just an ordinary large bathroom tile, white, which had cuts made into it, which had been done by somebody in the blood transfusion unit there, into little tiny squares. And then they'd made a wire with two little loops on the end. So you pricked the chap's thumb and got two little blobs of blood and mixed them on this tile and see how they reacted to the fluid on the tile. But when you think here, what you were deciding was what his blood group was. When you decided that he was invited to give blood, you couldn't compel him to give, you asked him to give it, and that blood was then sent up to the front, wherever that was, and it would be given to somebody on the record of what you had taken on those two little blobs of blood, which seemed very risky and very doubtful, and yet it seemed to work. But it seemed so crude.
Did most of the people give blood?
I would think about 60%. In some cases, you would get Sergeant Major come along and almost bully them into giving it. But we tried the majority of places where we took it was in I forget the name of the place. It was like a supply depot. They kept troops there until a dreadful situation. It's like when your shop runs out of goods, you replace them. When the fellas were killed up at the front, you replace them. You just send up another stock to replace those that had been killed. And this is where we normally went to get to ask for the blood. And the other thing which was remarkable, they were not blood group before they left England. I find that incredible, really. They send them out there, and the first time they get a blood group is when we do it, when they get there. But The sergeant major absolutely bullied them into it, but we used to work on the basis that it may be your turn next time. If you're going, you know, in a fortnight, 3 weeks' time, you may get shot. You may need blood yourself. So give it now in case you do. And it worked, as I say, I would say roughly 60% gave it. They, the other thing that was remarkable, they had everybody who gave a pint of blood had a bottle of beer given to them or offered to them. And you would find here was hard-bitten, tough soldiers who would rather have a cup of tea than a bottle of beer. It was unbelievable the way that that happened. You know, even like if a majority would rather have the cup of tea.
Yes, what date would this have been when you went into Italy? I wonder what was happening in Italy at the time.
Well, in Italy, they were coming up to the casino. They were just, you know, they'd been fighting to try, they'd landed on the beaches at Anzio and they'd been trying to get up to Rome. We used to send bottles of beer up to Anzio. This is how one of the little army corruptions. They send bottles of beer up to Anzio, and the Americans would send cases of sweets back for the soldiers. The beer was supposed to be for blood transfusion. People giving blood the blood donors, but they used to just shove no end of bottles in a case and send it up, and the army would send, and the American army would have the beer and then send sweets back for the British army. We went from, this was, I was in Naples at the time when that was going on, and then eventually I was blood grouping there, and then eventually I was transferred to a field transfusion unit, and that was up near to up on the Adriatic coast. And from there we went up the coast of Italy until this is one of the worst incidents up there, that, and I can't remember exactly where the place was, but the Germans resisted. It was somewhere near the River Po, I think, and they resisted for quite a long time, and there was a farmhouse in between the lines, and this was being shelled by both sides, and eventually the Germans pulled back and the British went in. They found a girl there with two broken legs and a broken arm and a broken jaw, I think. They brought her down to us. We weren't far away. And we were positive she was dead. But you could find just a faint flicker of a pulse. And normally you can put a needle into the vein in the arm, straight into the vein, without any problem. The vein was so dilated they had to cut down to put the needle in. And we gave her 4 pints of blood and she began to move. And I think she had about 10 pints of blood, and as far as I know, she recovered, but she looked in terrible state. And we went on further up, and we passed this village, and it smelt of the dead. It was horrible. And the village was completely ruined. I don't think I could see a house anywhere that anybody could have lived in. It was completely, you know, bombed by both and shelled by both sides. We had another incident there where a lot of Polish casualties brought in, bombed by the British planes. And then eventually we went on to River Po, and we'd just crossed the Po, and as we were doing so regularly, brewing up on the side of the road, and the newspaper there was the 8th Army News, and they slung these papers out at us as they drove past, and the war in Europe was over. It was wonderful. We then went on to Venice and spent some weeks in Venice, just outside Venice, and that was like a holiday, you know, just, and flew down to Rome and then to Naples and came home from Naples.
This time, were you working with the FAU or were you with the RAMC?
Well, the FAU with the RAMC. Mm. We had a group of about, how many would it be? 15 or something like that in this RAMC unit. The unit was about 30, 40 strong, that would be RAMC and about 15 FAU. That was the whole base and two field transfusion units. And then we in the field transfusion unit, it was an RAMC doctor, an FAU driver, and two other FAU fellows in it. That was the field transfusion unit, and we were attached to a casualty clearing station then.
How did you get on with the RAMC people?
Very well, except for one or two of the doctors, but the fellows very well indeed. I think, well, one or two of them were pacifists anyway, but I think the majority of them sort of thought, well, we were doing just what they were doing and just didn't take any more thought about it than that. You know, it's just sort of just the same sort of setup.
But the doctors were different, were they?
One or two of them were a little bit awkward, yes. Our own doctor was great because I didn't realise for some months after I'd been up there that he had tried to join the FAU. He was an Irishman, he was a pacifist. He tried to join the FAU and he'd waited and waited and they hadn't got a place for him, so he joined the RAMC. So he was very sympathetic, of course.
How about the troops? How did you get on with the troops? You know, these people you were taking blood from and or giving it to?
Oh, Not so bad. They thought they couldn't understand us, actually. They couldn't understand why anybody would volunteer to go out. I mean, if you were sent out there, that's one thing, but to volunteer to do it, you must be a bit of a nutter. Sort of.
Because you would have gone up to the front, wouldn't you? You know, in the danger zone.
We were, the casualty clearing station was within about 4 or 5 miles of the front, I think, but on one or two occasions I went up with one of the doctor's drivers up to the front, and well, within a mile of it, and the shells were coming over. Just the shells used to come over the casualty clearing station because the British guns were further back than the casualty clearing station. The shells would go right over the top going, you know, and there was some risk, I suppose. I mean, the shells were coming both ways and they wouldn't have known what a school was, a hospital, or they wouldn't have cared whether a school was a hospital, I suppose. But
did this have any effect on your pacifism, you know, actually being in the midst of action and, you know, seeing the sort of broken bodies? Did it reinforce or do anything?
Oh, I think it definitely reinforced it, yes, because the things we had to do, you know, I can remember one occasion there was a chap came in with his foot hanging on, a little bit of flesh and skin only, and I said to our Irish doctor, I said, what do I do with this? He said, get some scissors and cut it off. And I did that, and I thought, good God. The Germans had invented a mine, a very small anti-personnel mine, which didn't have any metal in it at all, and so it couldn't be detected. It was made out of wood, and all the instead of screws or nails, it was just wooden pegs that were holding it, so they could step on it and without even knowing it was there. And we had incidents of, you know, when the fighting was at its hardest, where you'd get perhaps in a day 7 or 8 fellows come in with foot blown off. And you think, this went on for days, and you think, God, the world's going to be full of cripples when it's all over. You know, it does seem to go on and on, that some casualties were terrible. But the other thing that really hit you was that you couldn't do anything for the... I know I mentioned this Italian girl brought into the hospital, but we, generally speaking, that we were the only hospital there, but generally speaking, they would be taken to a civilian hospital. And we had the parents of a little boy come to us once. They knew we had penicillin. The blood transfusion unit had a fridge on the van, and so we kept the penicillin. And somehow or other, one of the chaps in the RAMC, they used to go and fraternise in the village, they must have told them that we had penicillin. And their little boy had been badly injured, and they came and asked us for penicillin, and we couldn't give it them. Every bit you had was recorded, and so you couldn't do anything about it, you know. And we did ask our own officer, and he said, no, there's nothing we can do about it. Another occasion, we had a child carried in with both his feet broken, and just above the ankle, and we couldn't take him because there was a civilian hospital down in the town. I think that, you know, more than anything, made you realise the stupidity of it all.
You mentioned earlier as well that there was a shock research you did. Could you
yes.
tell me about that?
We,
and the case you
had. One day we had, this was again at Cesena, I think it was, or Rimini, or Cesena. And we had a lieutenant brought in. He was completely unconscious. I wouldn't have thought he was very old. I would say he was 25, 26, something like that. And this must have been late-ish afternoon, perhaps early evening, I don't know. And I was on at the time. And so we put him on. I put him onto blood. Gave them a pint, and you can give them, if they're really, you know, showing very little response to blood pressure, you can give it them quickly, you can pump it into them, so pumped 2 or 3 pints in, and he began to come round. And so I sent for the one of the orderlies, went to get the surgical team that consists of a surgeon and anaesthetists and about 3 RAMC personnel, and they came out. And when they got to the room I was in was next to the operating theatre. Excuse me. And when they came, I said, "I'm sorry, his blood pressure's gone down again." So they said, "Oh, we'll do what you can." And I gave him more blood, and it came up, and this happened about 3 times. And then the surgeon said, "Well, there's nothing we can do about it. We'll just have to operate." I can't remember what his injuries were, but they weren't severe. They'd seen many more severe cases than this. And they said they would operate, and so they took him in, and he died next morning. And later on that day, later on that morning it was, the major from the shock research team from the British Medical Association, although he was a major, he was really a civilian, and they put them into uniform to be in the battle zone, of course, and he came and saw me, and I said, "Well, I did what I could." And he said, "No," he said, "it's not your fault." He said, "I just want to know what you did." And I told him, and he said, "This is a case of shock." He said, "No matter how much blood you give them, the veins keep getting larger and larger, so the blood pressure never rises. It goes up and then goes down again." And he said, "So," he said, "you couldn't do anything about it." He said, "It's just one of the the reasons why we're out here, to try and find out what the cause of it is. I presume by now they've found it, but I mean, he was quite serious. He said he just didn't know why it happened, and no matter what we had done for that chap, he said he would never have recovered.
In your experience there, you know, with the blood transfusion unit, particularly when you went up, you know, with the casualty clearing station and went up to the front, do you think it was adequate, the service that you were able to give the wounded people? Did you always have enough blood?
We were never out of blood. We always had enough blood. I don't know where that was typical of everywhere, but we did. I never remember us having to have an emergency collection of blood, like from the people, like the staff in the casualty clearing station or anything like that. And I remember on one occasion we gave an Indian, I think he was definitely Indian. I'm just wondering whether he was a Gurkha, but I think he was an Indian, and we gave him about 30 pints of blood. I think he recovered in the end, but as fast as he was getting it, he was bleeding so badly. It was, and I'm sure it was 30 pints. It was the most I can ever remember us giving. And you can imagine what a strain that would be on the stock. But we used to fly it up, collected it in Bari, in southern Italy, and then it would be flown up to the nearest airfield, which was varied as we were going up country, of course. But that was the most I think we ever gave. I don't remember any real inadequacies, though. We had a very inadequate, after our own Irish doctor, chap called Mabin, this was when I was saying he was in, who tried to get in the FAU. After he left, he moved on somewhere else. And we had another doctor, and he was a complete and utter failure because he wasn't interested in the medicine. He would leave. I know we knew what we were doing, giving blood, but Mabin would supervise us. He would always be near enough to, you know, give us a hand or help out or something like that. But this chap used to go off for hours at a time, and we found out that he was going over to the nearest town in a jeep to see if he was mad about old guns, and he was spending most of his time collecting old guns instead of doing his work. And we were appalled. We thought it was disgusting. But generally speaking, I got a lot of time for those fellas. You know, you call a surgical team, perhaps be working 24 hours, they go to bed for 2 hours, and they'd be called out again. And never a quibble, you know. A bit of a long face, they liked it, but they did the job quite adequately. And as far as supplies were concerned, we always had whatever we wanted.
How about, you know, and did that apply to you as well? You know, would your day have included those long hours at times?
Well, there were two of us on. If there was a battle in progress, you could have been on for 24 hours, I suppose. You know, it depend on the number of casualties coming in. That would be two of us. Otherwise, we split it, and one would do nights and the other would do days, and we'd switch around, you see, and change it around.
What was it like when a battle was in progress? You know,
very hectic, very this time when all these poles were brought in, it was you know, ambulances pulling up at the front all the time, in front of the hospital, and casualties coming in, they'd be sorting them out, and then we had room for two casualties in our little room for that was resuscitation, and you would get
perhaps 3 or 4 or 5 waiting outside, you see. So you were trying to rush those in. You couldn't get rid of them until the surgical team was able to take them, because they had limited, in their operating theatre, would be limited room. Perhaps they would only have 2 on the go at a time. But you see, there's only one, as far as I know, there's only the one surgeon there. So I don't even remember 2 surgeons working in that place. There were physicians, there were 2 or 3, because apart from casualties, you had people with pneumonia and sort of various illnesses. You know, there were a number of them, but they were not capable of surgery. And the surgeons just worked like fury, you know. They were excellent. They learnt all the speed you had to do things. You know, it was so important, like speed was absolutely essential because of the number of cases you'd be brought in. Then, of course, you'd then go to the extreme where you'd go for days and you wouldn't have any sense at all, you know, perhaps go for weeks and...